which relied on a novel reading of the 14th Amendment and a nervy bid to test the interpretation. If that amendment, enshrined as law in the U.S. Constitution 4 years before, defined all native-born or naturalized persons as American citizens, and accorded those citizens privileges and immunities that could not be denied by the states, then women, who were persons, who were citizens, must enjoy those same privileges, including the franchise. It was simple. American women already possessed the right to vote. It was there in the Constitution, and women simply needed to exercise that right. A group of 170 New Jersey suffragists had tried the ploy in 1868. Their ballots were placed in a separate box and not counted. The plan, coordinated by Anthony and Stanton's infant organization, the National Woman Suffrage Association, was to get suffragists all over the country to attempt to vote in the presidential election of 1872. If the women were refused at the polls, lawsuits would be filed against the local election board, and hopefully the cases would be carried all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Like many civil rights activists to follow, they were provoking a legal test case. So on the first Tuesday of November, 1872, more than 150 women around the country, including Susan Anthony, her sisters, and her friends, did attempt to vote. In St. Louis, Missouri, a suffrage worker named Virginia Minor had tried to register to vote, but the election clerk refused her. She and her husband filed suit against the registrar. And in Battle Creek, Michigan, a former slave and political activist known as Sojourner Truth went to her local polling station to vote, but she was turned away. Truth was a veteran of the abolition and suffrage meeting circuits, mesmerizing audiences with her powerful testimonies to the indignities she suffered, being both black and female. It is reported that at an 1851 women's rights meeting in Akron, she famously challenged her white audience, "Aren't I a woman?" A question that would haunt the suffrage movement for years to come. For Truth, and all the other women who took part in this action of mass civil disobedience, the consequences they faced, including heavy fines, public rebuke, and possibly prison, paled in comparison with the thrill of demanding a ballot and taking the law into their own hands. Susan Anthony and her cohorts were arrested by a deputy U.S. Marshal and charged with illegal voting in a federal election, a criminal offense. As the most celebrated of the electoral scofflaws, Anthony was made an example by nervous government officials eager to quash this voting nonsense. She asked to be handcuffed and refused to post the $500 bail. She wanted to go to jail, all the better for publicity and legal maneuvering to a higher court. One of her lawyers, over her protests, paid her bail out of his own pocket. While awaiting trial, she set off on a headline-grabbing tour through every district in her home county, attracting large and sympathetic audiences to her fiery presentation, asking, "Is it a crime for a U.S. citizen to vote?" When prosecutors noticed that Anthony's performances might influence potential jurors, they moved her trial to another county. Undaunted, Anthony took to the platforms there. She made 50 speeches in all. Her trial, in U.S. District Court, was a sensation, covered daily by the national press, just as she'd hoped. Judge Ward Hunt, soon to take a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, would not allow Anthony to testify on her own behalf, and when the arguments of the prosecutors and defense lawyers concluded, Hunt pulled his written opinion from his pocket, obviously drafted before hearing any of the evidence of the case. He directed the men of the jury to bring in a verdict of guilty, and refused to poll them on their decision. When Anthony's attorney protested, Judge Hunt discharged the jury. Before sentencing her, Judge Hunt asked if the prisoner had anything to say. He got an earful. "Yes, Your Honor, I have many things to say," Anthony blasted. "For in your ordered verdict of guilty, you have trampled underfoot every vital principle of our government. My natural rights, my civil rights, my political rights, my judicial rights are all alike ignored. robbed of the fundamental privilege of citizenship, I am degraded from the status of a citizen to that of a subject. And not only myself individually, but all of my sex are, by your honor's verdict, doomed to political subjection under this so-called republican form of government. The court orders the prisoner to sit down, Judge Hunt snapped. She refused and continued. It will not allow another word, the judge bellowed. Exasperated, he finally imposed the sentence, a fine of $100 plus court costs or face imprisonment, though authorities had second thoughts about allowing her to become a jailed, noisy martyr. She wasn't jailed, never paid the fine, and there was no attempt to collect it. Anthony was unable to pursue her case to the U.S. Supreme Court, but Virginia Minor did. Minor's husband, Francis, a lawyer, filed a suit on her behalf, because women couldn't initiate lawsuits, against the election registrar, maintaining that Missouri's laws prohibiting women from voting were unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. Rebuffed in the lower courts, the Miners appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Francis Minor pleaded the case to the justices himself. The court ruled against them, saying that women were a special category of non-voting citizens. Members of the state was the term used. The High Court held that despite the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause, a state can prohibit women from voting. The ruling dashed any hopes that suffrage could be won through the courts, and by allowing a state to withhold the franchise from a whole class of citizens, the decision would lay the foundation for Jim Crow voter exclusions for nearly another century. The failed voting experiments of 1872, coupled with the U.S. Supreme Court defeat, forced Anthony and Stanton to reevaluate their strategies. Trying to change voting laws in every state, one by one, would take forever. So they renewed the idea of their own amendment to the federal Constitution, one that would correct the omissions of the post-Civil War 14th and 15th Amendments, when women were left out of the extension of the franchise to black men. It would supplant that malevolent phrase, male citizen, sneaked into the 14th, and add those three vital little letters, S-E-X, into the 15th's list of reasons why an American citizen could not be denied the right to vote. A 16th Amendment, an explicit woman suffrage amendment, became the primary goal of their new National Woman Suffrage Association, while its rival, Lucy Stone and Henry Blackwell's American Woman Suffrage Association, chose to pursue change state by state. Anthony and Stanton drafted and refined the wording of this new amendment, boiling it down to a single sentence, using the template of the 15th Amendment, and leaving no room for legal ambiguity. Quote, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex, unquote. They found their champion in Congress in Senator Aaron Augustus Sargent of California. Anthony had befriended the Sargent family on a train stranded in snowdrifts in the Rockies, and in the long hours trapped in the railroad car, she and the Sargents shared food and talked suffrage. Sargent became a trusted friend and advocate, withstanding the ridicule of his colleagues, and introduced the amendment into the Senate on January 10, 1878. It was referred to the Senate Committee on Privileges and Elections for consideration. It sat in Congress for the next 40 years. The amendment was reintroduced into every succeeding Congress, only to promptly disappear into the dark recesses of various committee file cabinets. It was allowed to surface briefly from time to time for hearings, where Stanton, Anthony, and other suffrage stateswomen were allowed to make their carefully reasoned arguments, only to be subjected to crass ridicule by the lawmakers. Stanton reported that during her testimony at one such hearing, the presiding senator clipped his fingernails, sharpened his pencils, and read the newspaper rather than pay attention. She said she had to restrain herself from throwing her manuscript at his head. Then the amendment would be tabled for another year. Carrie was in college when the amendment was introduced into Congress, and it had confronted its first Senate vote, a 2-1 defeat, in 1887, just as she joined the suffrage movement as a field organizer in Iowa. It had been stuck in Congress for a dozen years when she caught the eye of Susan Anthony, always on the lookout for young talent at the 1890 National American Suffrage Association convention. The amendment had already been tabled by Senate and House committees 10 times at the opening of the 1892 National Association convention in Washington, when Susan Anthony invited Kat to join the suffragists' annual trek to Congress. Anthony assigned her to be the first to testify for the amendment, obviously a test, and Kat had to think fast and speak off the cuff. It was her congressional debut, but only the first of scores of futile, infuriating trips to the Hill. There was little progress during the latter 1890s, while Kat became one of Aunt Susan's apprentices. With the amendment trapped in Congress, Anthony led her girls into a series of punishing state campaigns to alter constitutions or put the question of woman suffrage to popular referenda, in which, of course, only men had a say. There were a few victories, Colorado in 1893, Utah in 1896, and many more bitter defeats. The amendment had been marooned in Congress for a generation, 22 years, when an aged Susan Anthony brought Kat onto the stage of the 1900 National Association Convention and introduced her as her successor, confident that Kat had the skill and the passion to lead the movement. Kat also had the financial security of a prosperous and supportive husband, something many of the other contenders, including Anna Shaw, did not enjoy, enabling her to take on the unsalaried presidency. Kat tried to both shake up and shore up the National Association, emphasizing solid organizational structure and more centralized control, while also shifting the image of suffragism from radical to respectable by recruiting more professional and society women into the ranks. Now it was Carrie Kat leading the annual delegations to the Hill on behalf of the amendment, but Congress did not even consider the amendment during her first 4-year administration. After she stepped down from the presidency in 1905 and Anna Shaw stepped up, neither the Senate nor the House reported on the amendment in committee or considered it on the floor for almost another full decade, a maddening period some called the doldrums. Shaw was a great evangelist, but a poor administrator, and she lost control of the National Association. Into this void stepped Alice Paul, a 28-year-old Quaker woman from New Jersey with a Ph.D. from the University of Pennsylvania and several years' experience with Emmeline Pankhurst's corps in England, willing to undertake violent protests and suffer prison to make their point. The amendment had been gathering dust for 35 years when Paul and her fellow Pankhurst veteran Lucy Burns returned to the United States and took charge of the National Association's Congressional Lobbying Office, with plans to blast it out of its lethargy. That they did, but in the process they almost blasted the American suffrage movement apart too, or propelled it forward, depending upon one's point of view. By 1915, with Paul making headlines for her provocative actions and siphoning off some of the most talented suffs to her breakaway faction, the officers of the National were desperate for Anna Shaw to retire and for Carrie Kat to retake the helm. Kat reluctantly assumed the presidency again, just as the World War posed both a great human catastrophe and a great political opportunity for the movement. Everyone was forced to make sacrifices. Women gave their husbands, sons, and brothers. Alice Paul gave her body, tortured in jail. Carrie Kat gave her soul, joining the war effort she detested. Almost a year after America entered the World War, on January 10, 1918, both Carrie Kat and Alice Paul sat anxiously in the House galleries as the chamber voted on the amendment. Just the day before, Woodrow Wilson had finally announced his support for the amendment and urged Democratic congressmen to vote for it. Whether Wilson was influenced more by Paul's castigating or Kat's cajoling remains a matter of debate. Everyone knew the vote would be close. One congressman, a suffrage supporter, was wheeled in on a gurney, defying his doctor's orders to remain in the hospital. Another took his seat with a broken shoulder, refusing to have it set despite the pain, lest the anesthetic make him dopey. It brought tears to the eyes of the suffs in the House gallery to see Representative Frederick Hicks of New York appear on the floor, ashen-faced, having left his wife's deathbed at her insistence to vote for the amendment. He returned home for her funeral. The drama on the House floor was surpassed only by the harrowing tension of the roll call. The amendment passed the two-thirds majority threshold by a single vote. Kat and her suffrage sisters left the Capitol building, crying and singing hymns of joy. Despite the dangerously thin cushion, Kerry was certain that congressional victory, after 40 exasperating years, was near. The Senate would surely speed its consideration and approval of the amendment, and the elaborate plans she'd drawn for the ratification campaigns in every state could be launched before spring 1918. The Great War was still raging. Austerity was the byword. But Kat, in a burst of girlish enthusiasm, ordered her ratification dress to wear as she stumped in the States. Her friend Helen Gardner, one of the National Association's chief lobbyists in Washington, warned her, "You can't hustle the Senate." But Kerry went ahead and had the dress fashioned in her favorite color. The ratification dress hung in Kerry's closet for a full year and a half as the Senate dithered and filibustered and twice more voted down the amendment. When the Senate finally passed the amendment in early June 1919, Kat was not even in the Senate gallery. She refused to suffer through the torment of watching stubborn men make a mockery of justice any longer, and remained in New York. Molly Hay was there, keeping tallies with Marjorie Schuller and the National's lobbying team. They had to sit through the last vituperative gasps of opposition. One senator bloviated for 5 hours about the downfall of the nation. Other diehard senators introduced insidious amendments to the amendment, including one to allow the states to enforce the law as they saw fit, another inserting the word white to define the women citizens entitled to vote. When the amendment finally squeaked through, with a margin of votes you could count on one hand, Hay ran out of the chamber, commandeered a telephone, and called Kat at home. Kat listened quietly, placed the earpiece back in its cradle, and broke into a wild dance, stomping all over the house, whooping and singing. Then she calmed herself, settled down to her desk, and wrote telegrams to the governors of every state, asking them to convene their legislatures, in special session if necessary, to ratify the amendment. She quickly dispatched another batch of wires to all the National Association's state presidents. "Put your ratification plans into motion. Immediately." It was finally time to put on the blue dress. But before she could, it needed to be remodeled and shortened by a seamstress, as fashion styles had changed so rapidly in the meantime. It became a joke among her colleagues, a rare political miscalculation, a flight of wishful thinking by the master pragmatist. The dress was a good reminder to not count chickens until hatched, to not count votes till cast, to distrust talk of promises. It might be a good dress to wear in Tennessee, if it weren't so darn hot. Though the dress had hung in her closet for an infuriating 18 months, Kat eventually put it to good use as she blazed through the states, chasing the 36 required legislative ratifications. The anti-senators, in their spiteful wisdom, had delayed passage, knowing that sending the amendment out to the states in a year when most legislatures weren't in session would make it much more difficult to complete ratification with any speed. Most legislatures did not meet every year, and the governors of 30 states would have to be convinced to call their legislatures back for extraordinary sessions, which, many of them complained, involved too much bother, risk, and expense. The amendment faced an uphill climb in the states where the legislature, or the male voters, had rejected woman's suffrage time and again over the years, the states that had remained solidly black on the suffrage map. These states, most in the South and Northeast, would need to undergo quick conversions, or exorcisms, if they were to approve the amendment. Even the states that were white or polka-dotted on the map, those that had already enacted some form of suffrage for their women, might need to be cajoled into action. Kat knew ratification would be no cakewalk, but she believed that with strenuous work, it could be accomplished by the end of 1919. She was wrong. The first votes rolled in effortlessly. In the first week following submission of the amendment to the states, Illinois vied with Michigan and Wisconsin for the honor of being the first legislature to ratify. Wisconsin rushed its certification of ratification to Washington on a fast train, delivering it by hand to the Secretary of State. New York whisked its ratification through both houses in Albany in less than 3 hours, in a late-night special session. Minnesota's legislators stood and sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic in celebration of their ratification. Members of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives in Harrisburg also burst into patriotic song when the amendment passed in their chamber. Utah, where women had enjoyed the vote since 1896, approved the amendment unanimously, with an assemblywoman presiding over the quick, decisive roll call in the lower house. Ohio suffragists celebrated their legislature's ratification at a saloon, toasting their success with lemonade. But even as they quaffed their prohibition-compliant libations, antis were already busy circulating petitions to recall the ratification. After that initial burst of activity, within the first 3 months, 17 states were in the ratification yes column. The pace slowed, and the trouble began. Some governors used the excuse that it was too expensive to call a special session. Both Kat and Alice Paul encouraged suffragists in those states to ask their legislators to accept a bare-bones per diem. The legislators of a few states actually agreed to pay their own way back to the capital city. Suffs also volunteered to serve as secretaries, pages, and stenographers for the special sessions, to minimize state expense. A few governors expressed broader fears, nervous that calling a special session exposed them to danger. Revisited budgets, reconsidered bills, and hostile legislation slipped into the agenda. At least two governors worried that they might be impeached by their legislatures. Governor Ruffin Pleasant of Louisiana tried to organize a block of 13 southern governors to pledge to defy calls for special sessions, and, failing that, to do their best to defeat ratification in their legislatures. That would have killed the amendment for the foreseeable future, possibly for good, right then and there. He wasn't able to get his fractious fellow chief executives to go along, but Governor Pleasant and his wife made pilgrimages to many of the southern states to personally convince legislators to stand against ratification. Kat heard that Mrs. Pleasant was on her way to Nashville. Even in the few instances where suffs were victorious in the border states of the old Confederacy, as in Arkansas, they still had to endure the rabid rants of defiant legislators. "I'd rather see my daughter in a coffin than at the polls," one doting father exclaimed during floor debate in Little Rock. When Texas suffragists finally prevailed in the knockdown ratification brawl in Austin, the antis vowed to rescind legislative approval as soon as possible. But there was one statehouse melodrama below the Mason-Dixon line that the suffragists enjoyed. West Virginia State Senator Jesse Block's wild cross-country dash home from California, on special express trains, arriving at the Capitol in Charleston just in time to vote and break the tie in the state Senate, clinching ratification. One Oklahoma suff died fighting for ratification. Miss Aloysius Larch Miller, though seriously ill with the Spanish influenza, ignored her doctor's instructions to stay in bed and insisted upon speaking at a ratification rally. She summoned her strength to make an impassioned plea for a special session, stirred her audience to action, went home, and died 2 days later. The Oklahoma legislature made ratification of the amendment her memorial. Both the National Association and the Woman's Party headquarters dispatched teams of organizers to help augment state efforts and stir up popular demand for ratification. Alice Paul showed up in the state houses where legislatures were still in session in early June 1919, even before the amendment documents were delivered from Washington. In the next months, she sent her best organizers, including Sue White, to all the states where action on ratification was tardy or in jeopardy. In parallel but uncoordinated tactical moves, Carrie Catt sent Marjorie Schuller and other trusted deputies to the most troublesome states. When she sent Marjorie to reluctant New Hampshire, Catt told her, only half-joking, "You thought you had a real job in Vermont. That was only a pleasure trip. This is a job. Come through with your shield or upon it." The Spartan imagery was apt, because by the fall of 1919, the fight had grown grimmer, the opposition stiffer. Catt marched into the field herself. She put her dress to work again on her Wake Up America tour through the western states in the late fall of 1919, a trip to rally those states that had already accorded full suffrage to women, but somehow were taking a very lazy, to her mind, selfish approach to extending suffrage to the rest of the nation's women. The governors there were balking, and the state suffragists were too passive. Their women could vote. Why bother with ratification? By fall of 1919, only 5 of the 15 full suffrage states had ratified. Catt packed her ratification dress and jumped on a train. It was like one of her old barnstorming campaigns from the early days. 14 conferences in 13 states in a whirlwind 8 weeks. She gave pep talks. She administered scoldings. She negotiated with governors and legislators. 4,000 people packed the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City to hear her speak. It was nostalgic and gratifying, if also exhausting. She encountered women she'd worked with in her very first campaigns, in the horse and buggy days when some of these western states were still territories. The women were old and stooped, but still fighting, still working for change. And they traveled long miles to greet Catt tenderly, like old soldiers remembering their wars together. A high school beau from Iowa showed up at one of the rallies and proposed marriage to her. She smiled, thanked him, and pushed on to the next event. She wrapped up her Wake Up America tour with pledges from every governor she visited. Yes, they would call special sessions. Some continued to drag their feet, but, prodded by newly energized suffs in their states, they eventually came through. Still, by the end of 1919, only 22 states had ratified. By spring of 1920, the count had finally risen to 35, one vote away from victory. But since March, there'd been only rejections. In May 1920, Catt rallied a suffrage emergency corps of representative women from all 48 states to descend upon Connecticut in a massive lobby. The goal was to convince or shame stubborn Governor Marcus Holcomb to call the Connecticut legislature back into session to act on the amendment. The emergency corps was an impressive gathering of women doctors and lawyers, professors, scientists, and other professionals prominent in their fields. They held rallies in all the major cities and towns, gave rousing speeches. Catt herself spoke in New Haven, with the mayor at her side, and presented petitions and resolutions from tens of thousands of citizens demanding the session. Connecticut could have been the 36th state prize. All the polls indicated the legislature was willing to ratify, but the governor would not budge. Now, in July, he was still adamant. Voting women would not be good for the political health of Governor Holcomb or for his friend, Senator Frank Brandegee, both Republicans up for re-election in the fall, both rabid anti-suffragists. Now Governor Holcomb dared not set foot beyond the boundaries of his state because his lieutenant governor vowed to convene the legislature to ratify in his absence. But presidential candidate Warren Harding simply refused to intervene. Cat made an appearance in Richmond's capital to urge Virginia's ratification. The legislature still rejected the amendment and addressed the General Assembly in Dover, and was so sure that Delaware would become the 36th state. She left for Geneva, optimistic that the final state would be won while she was away, and she could return home to bask in glory, indulge in rest, putter in her garden at Juniper Ledge, retire the ratification dress. It didn't turn out that way, which was why she was forced to be in Tennessee. "It looks as though you will be lashed to the mast until after the special session, according to your wires," Clara Hyde, Cat's personal secretary at the national headquarters in New York, teased her boss. But news of Cat's intention to stay in Nashville for the duration made Sue White a bit nervous. "Things are interesting here," White joked in a note to Woman's Party headquarters. "I'm playing a four-hand. Mrs. Cat in town." While Cat established her base camp in Nashville, she also widened her field of view. She had to look at the big picture, look beyond Tennessee to Ohio, where the leaders of both the Democratic and Republican parties were gathering with their presidential candidates. It was where Cox's men in Columbus and Harding's men in Marion were making decisions about the upcoming campaigns, hatching plans, setting priorities, striking deals. It was where, she feared, political men were making their gentleman's agreement, just as they had in the Congress. During the agonizing Senate delays of 1918 and 1919, she and other suffragists frequently noticed a curious scene unfold during debate in the chamber. The small, obdurate band of Republican and Democratic suffrage opponents, Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, James Wadsworth of New York, Frank Brandegee of Connecticut, Oscar Underwood of Alabama, John Shields of Tennessee, what Cat called the Unholy Alliance, enjoyed the bonhomie of smug collusion. The Suffs watched these senators from opposite sides of the aisle, who were as divided as the Kaiser and the King of England on most policy issues, wrap their arms around one another's shoulders, slap backs, and laugh in jubilation. And Cat knew the amendment would be knocked down for another round. That's all it took. An understanding. That's what she feared was going on now in Ohio. Cat's suspicions weren't paranoid. They were practical. Why else would there be no report of Cox and President Wilson discussing ratification at their meeting? Because they were afraid of upsetting the Democratic base in the South? Why would Harding and the Republican leaders sit on their hands and make no real attempt to push the Vermont and Connecticut governors to grab the golden ring for the party, bring in the 36th state, get credit for securing the woman vote? Knowing men pretty well, I am very certain that these Republican governors would never have taken this action had they not been convinced that no Democratic state would enter the lists as the much-wanted 36th, Cat told a suffrage colleague. They are confident no Democratic state can be secured. They are too clever and crafty not to have some reason for that attitude. The reason, she was hearing from her political informants, was that a mutual agreement was being forged between the parties to stop the ratification count at 35 states, both parties doing their part to quietly block the amendment from going into force before Election Day. "We are now so convinced that the opponents have sewed us all up in a bag and will prevent ratification before the presidential election," she fretted to another suffrage colleague. It was easier this way, relieving both parties' anxiety about millions more unpredictable women voters flooding into the polls, upsetting apple carts. And, conveniently, neither party would get credit or blame for giving all women the vote. It would also protect vulnerable congressmen and senators who feared being punished by women voters for their long stands against suffrage. It made perfect sense. And if that weren't enough reason to stall ratification, the antis were already making good on their promise to throw injunctions and lawsuits in the path of state ratifications. And now they were also threatening to contest the presidential election itself, if ratification was completed in time and all women could vote in the fall. The chaos of a disputed White House contest was spooking both parties. Kat also heard that the antis were busy talking to the big party donors, painting a lurid picture of potential November madness, and convincing them to make their campaign donations contingent upon a pledge that the party would put the brakes on ratification, hold it where it stood, at a useless 35. After the election, well, who knew if the amendment would reach the 36-state threshold or if some of the antis' legal challenges to the completed ratifications would keep things in limbo for years longer. Kat felt that the women of America should not stand for it. She made her first move, sending a telegram to Esther Ogden, an officer of the National and a Democratic Party insider who served as Kat's personal envoy to the party leadership. Ogden was in Columbus awaiting the arrival of Cox, Roosevelt, and the Democratic National Committee, DNC, for their campaign planning powwow. Ogden was poised to pounce. Her demands were polite, but had a distinct edge. The party had the opportunity to render an act of supreme justice to the women of America, she told them. The amendment was on the verge of success, but the 35 ratifications it has to its credit make a lifeless record without the 36th to vitalize them. She insisted the DNC assume responsibility for securing ratification in Tennessee, and rest satisfied with nothing short of that achievement. The message Kat wanted to convey was between the lines, but perfectly legible. Enough of your resolutions and promises. We want action. Get some kind exclusive statement, Cox and Harding, Kat wired to Ogden. Put in newspapers and wire to me so I can give it publicity here. Ogden, who also wore the hat of president of the National Woman Suffrage Publishing Company, knew what the chief meant by exclusive, grabbing the press spotlight from Alice Paul, who'd commanded so many inches of newspaper space in the past week with her meetings with Cox and threat of confrontation with Harding. After presenting Kat's demands to the DNC, Ogden, together with a few other Democratic women, dined with Governor Cox, and Kat got her statement. Vague, but useful. Kat also sent a delegation of Republican women to Marion to wrangle a statement on Tennessee from Warren Harding. Harding was a sleek specimen of that genus of politician Kat found most odious. The white-plumed dissembler, the golden-throated waffler. She'd seen his kind before. For weeks he had been privately promising both the National and Woman's Party suffs that he would soon announce the good news of his efforts to convince the Vermont or Connecticut governors to call their special sessions. Republicans assured Kat, soon, soon. Nothing happened. The governors only dug their heels in deeper. Nothing can give us that state except the death of the governor, an exasperated Kat said of Vermont. And we haven't come to murder yet. The question now was, would Harding commit to influencing the Republican legislators in Tennessee to ratify? Ogden and the national delegation paraded into his office, unannounced, just as he was stepping out to dinner. Their meeting lasted just a couple of minutes. Whether Senator Harding was eager to improve his image among suffs, or simply eager to eat, isn't clear. But the women quickly left with their trophy in the form of a telegram to Mrs. Kat. I am exceedingly glad to learn that you are in Tennessee seeking to consummate the ratification of the Equal Suffrage Amendment, Harding said. If any of the Republican members of the Tennessee Assembly should ask my opinion as to their course, I would cordially recommend an immediate favorable action. Harding's statement, such as it was, went out to the newspapers, and Cat took some small pleasure in the press's mention that Harding's statement to her stole a march on the Woman's Party's plans to confront him at his notification ceremony the next day. Stealth always trumped screaming, Cat believed. But the oddly passive tone of the statement only confirmed Cat's suspicions about Harding. While on the surface the message seemed positive, it clearly revealed his reluctance to lift a finger for ratification in Tennessee or anywhere else. If they should ask me, and cordially recommend, were rather pathetic commands from the man who wanted to be commander-in-chief. As to his exceeding gladness that she was in Nashville, Cat realized it probably meant that Harding was simply relieved that she was not camped on his doorstep in Marion, ready to make a scene. But Alice Paul and Sue White were. Chapter 9. Front Porch. Warren Gamaliel Harding had a very fine front porch. It sat on a limestone block base, surmounted by a handsome white balustrade, with pairs of Ionic capitaled columns rising up, giving it that classical revival look. It was all American, Midwestern solid, forthright, strong. From that porch, Warren Harding intended to catapult himself into the White House. He had no plans to go out on the stump, wear himself down crisscrossing the nation, plead for votes from sooty train cabooses and rickety platforms. He could just stay at home, sleep in his own bed every night, let the voters come to him. They'd see him in his comfortable, natural habitat, his own hometown of Marion, Ohio, and understand and admire him all the more. A front porch campaign. It had worked for those other Ohio Republican presidential candidates, James Garfield in 1880 and William McKinley in 1896, and Harding was sure it would work for him. It lent an aura of above-the-fray statesmanship and calm electoral confidence. It also protected him from unwelcome scrutiny. The nation would come to Marion, to his porch. This Thursday, July 22nd, was the official start of the campaign, Notification Day, when the Republican Party came to its chosen candidate's home to complete the nomination process. A fixture of 19th and early 20th century presidential campaigns, Notification Day was a strange mixture of political wedding, coronation, homecoming parade, and 4th of July celebration. Marion had never experienced anything quite like this, but it was thrilled. A Marion Civic Association was hastily formed to prep the town for its moment in the spotlight. Every store, almost every store downtown, was dressed up in red, white, and blue bunting. Every house had a photo of Harding in the front window. Hundreds of local men and women were deputized as official greeters and hostesses. Enough food to provide two meals for all the visitors was on hand, with restaurant pantries bulging and 30 quarters of beef roasting on spits on the high school playing field. Dozens of special chartered trains were headed to the Marion station, loaded with Republican legislators and dignitaries. Thousands more spectators would pour in on trains and in automobiles. Between 50 and 100,000 visitors were expected in Marion for Notification Day. Among those expected, with some degree of dread, was Alice Paul and a troop of her Woman's Party militants. Republicans enjoyed the picketers when they were protesting against Wilson and the Democrats these past years, but were horrified when the women turned fire on their party convention in June. Convention delegates complained of being unable to enter the Chicago Coliseum without passing a gauntlet of stubborn suffragettes who assaulted them with signs and slogans and accusatory glares. The militants had unfurled a banner over the balcony of the convention center, reading, "Why does the Republican Woman's Party block suffrage? We do not want planks. We demand the 36th state." Woman's Party picketers were not welcome in Marion. Certainly not at this grand celebration of Warren Harding, native son. But Harding's advisors knew that Paul must be handled carefully, or things could get ugly. Alice Paul and her women had come chasing after Harding as soon as he won the nomination, cornering him in Washington when he was having his first meetings with campaign officials. That's when he told them that he would not attempt to force any state to ratify the federal suffrage amendment, and he would not push the Connecticut or Vermont Republican governors. I could not with propriety attempt to force any chief executive to hasten action in violation of his own sense of duty, he told the women come to plead with him. It's the same old bunk, sputtered one Woman's Party member from Texas, who considered herself a good Republican after the meeting with Harding. Another accused Republicans of chicanery, false promises, and dilatory tactics, and warned that women were getting so fed up with both parties that a third party, a real woman's political party, was not an idle threat. Harding further antagonized the suffragists when, under pressure from his party, he began making some half-hearted, perhaps duplicitous efforts to bring the Connecticut and Vermont governors into line. He kept promising the suffs that he'd soon have good news to report about special sessions in those states, but the good news never came. Republican operatives reassured the suffragists that the delay was really just a publicity ploy to make it seem as though Harding were negotiating furiously, solving a difficult diplomatic problem, being very presidential. But success was definite. Then, just a few days before notification day, a Hartford newspaper asked Harding if he would advise Connecticut Governor Marcus Holcomb to call a special session. I answer no, Harding replied. Alice Paul loudly announced that there would be pickets in Marion on notification day, and they would stay all summer if necessary. The last thing Republicans wanted was a wire service photo showing suffrage women being forcibly turned away from the launch of the presidential campaign. Negotiations began. Harding's handlers offered the Woman's Party delegation a handshake and photo opportunity with the candidate. Alice Paul rejected that. Harding's staff then suggested that the suffragists join the parade marching by the front porch, but no chanting or hostile demonstrations. Paul said no again and gave the signal for the picket signs to be assembled. Finally, a compromise was struck. Two party representatives would be allowed to address short statements to Harding on the front porch, but only if Paul called off the picketing. Somewhat reluctantly, Paul agreed. Warren and Florence Harding had been married in the parlor of the green-shingled, Queen Anne-style beauty he built on Mount Vernon Avenue for his bride in 1891. He was only 26 years old, but already a successful newspaper publisher. He grew up nearby, in the small town of Caledonia, went to a local college, and at age 19 chipped in with two buddies to buy a bankrupt newspaper, the Marion Pebble. He signaled his intentions to make the paper something larger and more profitable by renaming it the Marion Star. Florence Kling was 30, daughter of the richest man in Marion, who also owned the town's rival newspaper. She was a gifted pianist and had a good head for business, better than Warren's, and she became the Star's business manager, boosting circulation and profits. Warren was happiest in the press room, setting type and composing pages with the printers, or at lunch at the commercial club, making the Star, and himself, a pillar of the community. Florence was ambitious for her husband, and was not at all displeased when he entered politics. First state senator, then lieutenant governor, then a failed bid to be governor of Ohio in 1910, but a successful run for the U.S. Senate in 1914. Florence helped Warren with his speeches, his press releases, his political maneuvers, his wardrobe. Warren didn't make much of an impression in the Senate. He missed almost half of the roll call votes and ducked out when many of the most controversial issues were being debated. But by lying low, he didn't make enemies, and did make friends. He was always well-liked, if not enormously respected. He watched how the political winds blew and sailed with them. When the 19th Amendment seemed inevitable, he voted for it, which pleased Florence, as she was a keen suffragist. The ceremonies began as soon as the sun came up, with the Harding marching band, composed of neighbors, friends, and town boosters, noisily arriving at the Harding home for a flag raising. Harding came onto the porch to greet the early morning revelers, climbed down the steps, and pulled on the ropes of the flagpole to raise the stars and stripes, and for the next 7 hours, the happy, noisy outpouring continued. Bands and glee clubs, Republican groups from around the country wearing top hats, capes, and costumes, brigades of scouts and soldiers, farmers and printers. The Marion Star gave its staff a half holiday. Harding was most delighted by the musical greeting of his old bandmates from Caledonia, with whom he'd played the trombone long ago. The men made a valiant effort to fit into their old uniforms and coax melodies from their ancient instruments in his honor. In the doorway of the house leading to the porch, Albert Lasker watched the festivities. This was the opening act in his plan to shape and sell Warren Harding to the American people. Lasker was an accomplished Chicago advertising man, known for his clever campaigns for canned pork and beans, California oranges, and Quaker puffed cereal. Shot from guns. Now his product was a middle-aged marshmallow of a man from small-town America. You had to work with what you were given, who needed to project strength, calm, and security, with a dash of pizzazz. This front porch was a brilliant stage, and Lasker was lining up a cavalcade of high-wattage celebrities to visit and endorse Harding here. Movie stars, sports legends, Broadway and vaudeville luminaries. Al Jolson was writing a Harding song and would sing it on the porch. The press were going to love it. Lasker was going to give Americans the president they wanted, and he'd tell them why they wanted Harding. A few blocks away, Sue White slipped a purple, white, and gold sash over her white dress. She'd just begun launching the Nashville campaign when she received a telegram from Miss Paul, asking her to return to Ohio to take part in the Harding deputation. She was reluctant at first. She had 1,000 details to attend to in Nashville, but when Miss Paul gave a command, or even a request, there was no refusing. White's train from Nashville had arrived in Columbus on Wednesday, just in time for her to dash to the afternoon meeting of the Executive Committee of the Republican National Committee, RNC, at the Deschler Hotel, where she made the case for a concerted Republican Party effort to get every Tennessee Republican legislator on board for ratification. Early the next morning, White, along with Woman's Party staff organizer Anita Pollitzer and board member Louisine Havemeyer of New York, made the 60-mile trip straight north from Columbus to Marion for notification day. It was like old times. Pollitzer was White's close friend, a fellow Southerner from South Carolina, and a seasoned field worker who'd worked shoulder to shoulder with her in many of the toughest ratification skirmishes. They had an easy understanding, a sisterly bond, an unspoken trust. They could make each other laugh. White was very glad that Pollitzer would soon be joining her in Tennessee. Miss Paul was already in Marion, micromanaging, as usual, every detail of the event. Her tiny body was in constant motion, her dark eyes intense. She never raised her voice, but gave firm, precise, some thought imperious commands. Her authority was unquestioned among her followers. Her power was the quiet, ferocious force of moral certainty. Miss Paul never asked her Woman's Party troops to do anything she would not be willing to do herself. She was no armchair general who sent her soldiers into peril, while she directed from safety behind the lines. Paul was a true leader, White often marveled, always with her women, in the front line of every assault. And, more than any of them, suffering the consequences. It was hard, even for Sue White and the other party activists, to understand how this slight, pale, shy, and seemingly frail woman could not only mount the barricades, but endure the torture she'd been subjected to by the authorities, the police, and the White House. Physical and mental torture. The many imprisonments, the solitary confinement, the hunger strikes and forced feedings. Strapped to a table, tubes rammed down her nose, lacerating her throat. And then the ultimate degradation, the attempt to undermine her leadership, the claim that she was insane. They sent psychiatrists to examine Paul and threatened to commit her to St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital. She was perfectly sane, of course, and the doctors had to admit they could find nothing at all wrong with her mind. She emerged with her spirit unbroken, but the imprisonments had had an effect. Everyone at headquarters could see Miss Paul was, even now, a few years later, still prone to periods of illness, pain, depression, and exhaustion. But she was unwilling to slow down. Certainly not now. Miss Paul was darting among the 200 Women's Party marchers, women from 15 states lining up for the parade. The trunks of regalia, filled with sashes and flags and banners, were unlocked and thrown open. Tall, polished wood poles were fitted with the party's purple, white, and gold fabric gonfalons. The women, all dressed in white, donned their tricolored sashes, hoisted the poles, stretched out the banners, and stepped to the beat of the brass band assigned to lead them. They marched in a long, single line through the streets of Marion, with every state's name held high on a vertical cloth pennant striped in the Woman's Party colors. Leading the processional was a giant banner, stretching almost the entire width of the street, carried on each end by distinguished suffrage veterans, including Lizzie Crozier French of Knoxville, who managed to be a member in good standing of both the National and the Woman's Party. It was a rather wordy pronouncement to carry around. It certainly could have been punchier, but it managed to get its message across. The Republican platform endorses ratification of suffrage. The first test of the platform will come when the Tennessee legislature meets in August. Will the Republicans carry out their platform by giving a unanimous Republican vote in Tennessee for suffrage? When the first line of suffragists reached the edge of the front porch, those behind fanned out to form a semicircle, many rows deep, facing the Hardings. They set down the base of their poles onto the lawn, but held them upright, so the banners were still aloft and very visible. The Woman's Party representatives walked up the porch steps to be introduced to Senator and Mrs. Harding. Alice Paul had chosen her two speakers for the occasion with care. Women who could speak cogently, colorfully, and loudly. Sue White would represent Tennessee and the aspirations to make it the 36th state. Louisine Havemeyer of New York would speak for the women who already had the vote and intended to use it against Warren Harding if he didn't shape up. Miss Paul had begged Havemeyer to travel to Marion for this event, even though she knew the overnight trip in a bumpy sleeper train car would be uncomfortable and tiring for the plucky 65-year-old grandmother. Havemeyer was the Woman's Party's most popular speaker, vivid, funny, disarming. She charmed audiences and had a big, booming voice that could carry in the open air. She knew how to make a sharp point, embellished by erudite asides and curlicues of wit. She was the extremely wealthy widow of Henry Osborne Havemeyer, the Sugar King, whose family owned the American Sugar Refining Company, which controlled virtually all sugar supplies in the nation. She and Harry had enjoyed collecting art, and with the advice of Louisine's close friend Mary Cassatt, the American painter, they assembled one of the world's great collections. They commissioned Lewis Comfort Tiffany to design the furniture and stained glass windows for their Fifth Avenue mansion. Harry Havemeyer was a resolute suffrage supporter, encouraging his wife to sign petitions and get involved. When Harry died in 1907, Louisine plunged more deeply into suffrage activities, displaying a taste for the more radical strain of the movement. She joined and helped bankroll the short-lived Women's Political Union.